Now on BBC Radio 4, we present David Suchet in The Gory Details, a celebration of the life and work of the American writer and illustrator Edward Gorey.
A was an author who went for a walk. B is a broadcast they based on his talk. C, for yourself what you think of it all.
His attitude toward the world was extremely unusual, detached, quirky, ironic, right from the beginning.
He was one of those damn liberals, of course.
When I was a child in New York, he was always just sort of a presence. He was to be seen at the ballet in a raccoon skin coat and canvas basketball shoes with a beard, and it was very hard to miss him.
Join me now on a quest for the gory details with two or three of his friends, colleagues, and admirers, some of Edward Gorey's work, and a few things he's said about it over the years. And to help us on our way, a story.
The Unstrung Harp, or Mr. Earbrass Writes a Novel. Mr. C. Clavius F. Frederick Earbrass is, of course, the well-known novelist. Of his books, A Moral Dustbin, More Chains Than Clank, Was It Likely, and the Hip Deep Trilogy are perhaps the most admired. On November the 18th of alternate years, Mr. Earbrass begins writing his new novel. Weeks ago, he chose its title at random from a list of them he keeps in a little green notebook. It being tea time of the 17th, he is alarmed not to have thought of a plot to which the unstrung harp might apply. But his mind will keep reverting to that one last biscuit on the plate.
Thus begins Edward Gorey's first book as writer and illustrator, The Unstrung Harp, or Mr. Earbrass Writes a Novel, which was published in the USA 50 years ago, in 1953.
I've always found it peculiar that the first book I wrote was about an author, because I wasn't an author and I really knew nothing about it. I made the whole thing up, and of course it's come true.
In a way, it's true that The Unstrung Harp became an autobiographical novel, although, as I remember it, the man in The Unstrung Harp had a strange name, like Mr. Earbrass, I believe, had much more trouble with composition than Edward Gorey ever did, and he certainly didn't give the impression that he was going to produce nearly 100 charming or frightening or amusing books.
Alison Lurie, the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist who was at Harvard University with Edward Gorey, and yes, he did indeed go on to draw and write nearly 100 strange and distinctive little books. His intricately cross-hatched pen and ink drawings seem to convey a very particular Edwardian sense of foreboding. Something unsettling is about to happen, or has recently happened, or may not happen after all. In the garden, the ever-present urns are oddly unnerving, and something may well be lurking in the shrubbery. Not that you're any safer indoors. Vast drawing rooms are hung with strangely menacing wallpaper. Gentlemen in monocles gather in groups. Listless ladies seem on the brink of swooning. Tiny children frolic in the corridors, oblivious of their imminent doom. Nameless dread is the order of the day, fraught and surreal and utterly beguiling.
Mr. Earbrass has rashly been skimming through the early chapters, which he has not looked at for months, and now sees the unstrung harp for what it is. Dreadful. 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 He must be mad to go on enduring the unexquisite agony of writing when it all turns out drivel. Mad. Why didn't he become a spy? How does one become one? He will burn the manuscript. Why is there no fire? Why aren't there the makings of one? How did he get in the unused room on the third floor?
A strange and solitary gentleman was our Mr. Gorey.
A was an author who went for a walk. B was a bore who engaged him in talk.
He tended to shun company and lived alone, if you can call it alone, when you're surrounded by a phalanx of cats. Toweringly tall, he was occasionally to be glimpsed in the streets of New York, muffled in an enormous fur coat and shod in white sneakers. He drew himself that way in several of his books, just as Alfred Hitchcock used to make playful cameo appearances in his own movies.
O was an opening let in a wall. P was a place he did not know at all. Q was the question he asked of a stranger. R, the reply that his life was in danger.
When Edward Gorey's odd little volumes began to appear, most people assumed that their author was A, English, and B, dead. In fact, at that time he was, of course, very much alive, and had never even visited England. That misleading middle name of his was not pronounced St. John in the British style, but St. John. Edward St. John Gorey was actually born in Chicago in 1925. As it happens, he seldom traveled anywhere at all, and only left America once.
Before he knew what he was doing, Mr. Earbrass found he had every intention of spending a few weeks on the continent. In a trance of efficiency which could have surprised no one more than himself, he made the complicated and maddening preparations in no time at all.
Gorey went off on a trip to the Outer Hebrides, which seems strangely appropriate. But why there?
I know where I'm going, and I know who's going with me. I know who.
I saw a wonderful old British movie called I Know Where I'm Going with Wendy Hiller. As a very determined, headstrong kind of girl who plans to marry someone and then get stranded in a terribly remote Scottish village. Well, I fell in love with Wendy Hiller and the scenery, and I knew right away that I had to go there. I called in at Loch Ness, too, but I didn't see the monster, which, of course, was a great disappointment to me.
I'm sure the monster must have been disappointed, too. Something tells me Nessie and Gorey would have got on famously. Even though he never visited England, Gorey's work seems to be set in a grey and gloomy England of the imagination, compounded from his vast reading of authors ranging from Ivy Compton Burnett and Agatha Christie, whose books he adored, to Edward Lear and Lewis Carroll.
The Doubtful Guest by Edward Gorey. When they answered the bell on that wild winter night, there was no one expected and no one in sight. Then they saw something standing on top of an urn whose peculiar appearance gave them quite a turn. All at once it leapt down and ran into the hall, where it chose to remain with its nose to the wall. It was seemingly deaf to whatever they said, so at last they stopped screaming and went off to bed.
This dubious guest is a small and inscrutable penguin-like creature in a scarf and sneakers. It has turned up, uninvited and unannounced, at a rather bleak country house.
It joined them at breakfast and presently ate all the syrup and toast and a part of a plate. It wrenched off the horn from the new gramophone and could not be persuaded to leave it alone. It betrayed a great liking for peering up flues and for peeling the soles of its white canvas shoes. At times it would tear out whole chapters from books or put roomfuls of pictures askew on their hooks. Every Sunday it brooded and lay on the floor, inconveniently close to the drawing-room door. Now and then it would vanish for hours from the scene, but alas be discovered inside a tureen. It was subject to fits of bewildering wrath, during which it would hide all the towels from the bath. In the night through the house it would aimlessly creep, in spite of the fact of its being asleep. It would carry off objects of which it grew fond, and protect them by dropping them into the pond. It came 17 years ago, and to this day it has shown no intention of going away.
Alison Vuery has an interesting theory about the inspiration for The Doubtful Guest.
I've always thought that The Doubtful Guest, which was published just after I began to have children back in the 1950s that it had something to do with my own kids, because the doubtful guest is this creature that suddenly appears in a household. It doesn't speak. It lies on the floor. It eats everything in sight. And finally, at the end, you get the couplet, "It came 17 years ago, and to this day, it has shown no intention of going away." Well, 17 or 18 years is about what you get when you have a baby.
Which may very well be so. Gori's works often do start from some particular inspiration, but then the alchemy begins within his extraordinary imagination.
Even more harrowing than the first chapters of a novel are the last, for Mr. Airbrass anyway. The characters have, one and all, become thoroughly tiresome, as though he had been trapped with them at the same party since the day before. Neglected sections of the plot loom on every hand, waiting to be disposed of. His verbs seem to have withered away, and his adjectives to be proliferating past control. Furthermore, at this stage, he inevitably gets insomnia. Even rereading The Truffle Plantation, his first book, does not induce sleep. In the blue horror of dawn, the vines in the carpet appear likely to begin twining up his ankles.
In my quest for the gory details, I made a pilgrimage to the legendary Gotham Bookmart in New York City. It's one of the world's great bookshops, somewhat unexpectedly tucked away in the middle of New York's Diamond District. Its owner is Andreas Brown, a longtime friend and champion of Edward Gorey and his work.
Edward was a child prodigy. He was a very brilliant man. He taught himself to read when he was three and a half, according to his mother. She came into a room and found him reading a book. He was found making his first drawing when he was a year and a half old. He was sitting at a window at his grandparents' house with a pencil and a piece of paper, and when they examined what he was doing, he was drawing a train which was passing through a valley below the window. And by the time he was 7 or 8, he'd read a lot of the classics.
I'd like to be able to say that I was a lonely, miserable child, poor, poetic little me, but it simply was not true. I was out playing kick the can along with everyone else.
He took the National University exams when he was 17, got a 4-year scholarship to Harvard, and he was caused quite a stir at Harvard. He arrived during one of those wonderful golden ages of academic institutions where a group of people sort of come together from all the four corners of the community and form a kind of loosely knit group that becomes almost inspired in their creativity of feeding off of each other. In this case, it was John Ashbery, the Pulitzer Prize poet, Frank O'Hara, who by chance draw was assigned to meet at Elliott House, Alison Lurie, the Pulitzer Prize novelist.
My first impression of Edward Gorey when I was first introduced to him in a bookshop was that he was a very strange-looking guy. He was very tall, very thin, and odd-looking. But, of course, so were his friends. They were a bunch of eccentrics and what would now be called by conventional college students weirdos. So he didn't stand out as being stranger than the others. Of course, when I first met him, he didn't have the beard. He didn't have all the rings. He didn't have the fur coat. All he had was the sneakers and a black turtleneck. So he didn't seem as striking a figure as he became later.
For writing, Mr. Airbrass affects an athletic sweater of forgotten origin and unknown significance. It is always worn hindsight too. The first draft of The Unstrung Harp is more than half finished, and for some weeks its characters have been assuming a fitful and cloudy reality. Now, a minor one named Glassglue has materialized at the head of the stairs, and his creator is about to go down to dinner. Mr. Earbrass was aware of the peculiarly unpleasant nubs on his greatcoat, but not the blue-tinted spectacles. Glassglue is about to mutter something in a tone too low to be caught and, stepping sideways, vanish.
Although he majored in French, Gorey spent most of his time at Harvard with the Poets Theatre Group, devising avant-garde productions with titles like The Teddy Bear, A Sinister Play. Then he went to work for a New York publishing house, designing paperback covers and book jackets.
Mr. Earbrass has received the sketch for the dust wrapper of the Unstrung Harp. Even after staring at it continuously for 20 minutes, he really cannot believe it. Whatever were they thinking of? That drawing? Those colors? Ugh! On any book, it would be ugly and illegible. On his book, it would be these and also disastrously wrong.
Gradually, Gorey also began to see some of his own books in print. But the strange little volumes caused a degree of bafflement in the middle 1950s. The drawings were charming and the words amusing, but what were they? Albums of drawings? Cartoons? At first glance, they looked for all the world like books.
I think there are some children that have loved his books, loved certain of his books, but some of them are quite strange or frightening, maybe too frightening for most children. Though I do meet people who say, oh, I've loved his books since I was 11 or 12 years old.
I'm Alexander, and I'm 11 years old and in secondary school at the moment. My favourite collection is Edward Gorey. He's got a very unique, like, Victorian, Edwardian style. They're usually black and white drawings, very scratchy, kind of shaded in. Whatever there is in it, it's always really good.
Some weeks later, with pen, ink, scissors, paste, a decanter of sherry, and a vast reluctance, Mr. Earbrass begins to revise the Unstrung Harp. This means, first, transposing passages, or reversing the order of their paragraphs, or crumpling them up furiously and throwing them in the wastebasket. After that, there is rewriting. This is worse than merely writing, because not only does he have to think up new things, but at the same time try not to remember the old ones. Before Mr. Earbrass is through, at least one-third of the Unstrung Harp will bear no resemblance to its original state. Mr. Earbrass arrives at the offices of his publishers to deliver the Unstrung Harp. The stairs look oddly menacing, as though he might break a leg on one of them. Suddenly, the whole thing strikes him as very silly, and he thinks he will go and drop his parcel off the embankment and save everyone concerned a lot of fuss.
Gorey's early books bore wonderfully tantalizing titles like The Listing Attic, The Fatal Lozenge, The Hapless Child, and The Curious Sofa. But they didn't seem to catch on, and he drifted from publisher to publisher.
I never changed publishers. They always changed me, as it were. They all thought they were going to make a splash with whichever particular book they were doing at the time. And then they would do, say, one or two, and the splash didn't arrive, so they would say, reluctantly, well...
Eventually, Gorey started publishing his books himself, under his very own imprint, the Fantod Press. His books are instantly recognizable, almost always in small format, in meticulous black-and-white cross-hatching, elegantly hand-lettered. Even though every book is clearly Gorey through and through, he employs a number of highly unconvincing pseudonyms. Some of them are anagrams of his name.
Ogred Weary. Drew Dogear.
Garrod Weedy.
Dej Yarrow. E.G. Deadwarry.
Wardory Eddie.
Dreary Wodge.
Amazing how versatile those 11 letters can be. Generally, the pen name he chooses is somehow appropriate to the book, so his homage to Agatha Christie is ostensibly by
Miss D. Audrey Gore.
Some of his other female alter egos include
Mrs. Regera Doughty
and the keen-eyed girl detective
Dora Gradu.
I think it allowed him to write in slightly different ways. I mean, the work of Ogden Weary was not quite the same as the work of Mrs. Regera Doughty, for instance.
Quite so, for who else but Adi Gorwi, the postcard poetess, could pen such a deathless couplet as this.
Turnips are turnips, and prunes are prunes, whether eaten with forks or eaten with spoons.
So he could take on these semi-personalities and use them to diversify his output.
I wanted to publish everything under a pseudonym from the very beginning, but everybody said,
"What for?"
And I couldn't really explain why I wanted to. I still don't know exactly, except that I think what you publish and who you are two different things.
I don't really see that much connection. All things considered, I'd be happier if nobody knew I did anything.
Gorey is also fond of offering helpful and improving advice in verse form. It ranges from the severely practical.
A 1 or 2 inch piece of string cannot be used for anything.
To almost proverbial little maxims.
Don't leave the shore without an oar.
To matters of etiquette. Oh, let us be elegant or die.
It's possible to pick up crumbs by pressing on them with the thumbs. A random thought, if said aloud, may soon attract a hostile crowd.
To invaluable tips on a whole variety of topics.
The helpful thought for which you look is written somewhere in a book. At twilight, objects often start to make odd sounds and fall apart. One cannot hope to end one's life with nothing but a butter knife.
All of which is strangely consoling, don't you think?
Before returning home to Mortshire, Mr. Earbrass allows himself to be taken to a literary dinner. Among his fellow authors, a few of whom he recognizes and none of whom he knows, are Locke, Sandwich, Haperth, Avuncular, and Lord Legbale. The unwell-looking gentleman wrapped in a greatcoat is an obscure essayist named Froust. The talk deals with disappointing sales, inadequate publicity, worse than inadequate royalties, idiotic or criminal reviews, others declining talent, and the unspeakable horror of the literary life.
Gorey found a much wider audience in the early 1970s, thanks to Andreas Brown of the Gotham Bookmart.
I remember when we proposed to Edward that he do an anthology, and the problem grew out of a genuine need. His audience primarily back in the 60s and 70s were young people. And as his very precious Fantod Press books became rarer and rarer, which they did, they would go up to $50 or $100 a piece. Gorey completely designed Amphigory, included 15 of his early classic books, brilliantly designed, and the New York Times picked it as one of the 5 outstanding art books of the year. The Institute of Graphic Arts picked it as one of the 50 best design books of the year. The book has never gone out of print since 1972 or 3 when it was published. And I imagine there are a quarter of a million copies that have been put into print, maybe more. And it dramatically changed Edward's life in the sense that for the first time, the mainstream retail book industry carried Edward Gorey in their stores. They were no longer these peculiar, eccentric, small little books that didn't fit on the regular shelf and you didn't know whether to put it in the children's department or adult literature or where you put it, or humor. And I think millions became addicted as a result of that book.
One of the many people who became addicted through Amphigory was Stephen Appleby, the British cartoonist. Some years later, he actually went to visit Gorey.
We drove to Cape Cod and arrived at the sort of address, which was a kind of square, well, houses around a green, basically. Mm-hmm. And it was all kind of immaculate looking. The houses were all white, clapboard houses, and the grass on the green was beautifully cut and everything. And I felt kind of disappointed because I thought, oh, he might just be just completely kind of a normal, ordinary person. and that would be a bit of a shame. And then I spotted that one of the houses on around this green had all the paint peeling off and was just kind of grey with lack of paint, and the garden was all overgrown and all the other gardens were immaculate. And I went up to the door and I had to kind of push through bushes to get to the door. It wasn't easy to get to. And I knocked on the door and there was no answer.
Mr. Earbrass has driven over to Nether Millstone in search of forced greengages, but has been distracted by a second-hand bookseller's. Rummaging in the two-shilling section among mostly religious tracts and privately printed reminiscences, he has come across The Meaning of the House, his second novel. In making sure it had not got there by mistake, he discovers it is a presentation copy. For Angus, will you ever forget the bloaters? Bloaters? Angus!
And I went round the side of the house and I could hear a typewriter. And he came and let me in, you know, and I knocked on the side door. But he was fantastic because he was, you know, had loads of cats, surrounded by cats. And we sat in a chair in a window by the typewriter, and there was a cat sort of on his head and one on his lap. No, not on his head, sort of around his neck like a kind of fur wrap, you know, on his shoulders. And another one sort of on the table to the side, you know.
The Amphigory anthology was not the only major event in Gorey's life in the 1970s. The other was a revival of Dracula, which was originally produced in a little theatre in Cape Cod where he always stayed in the summer. It took a lot of persuading to get him involved with designing the show, but it became a smash hit and transferred to Broadway. The decor was in black and white throughout, with just a single vivid splash of red in each act.
There were three spots of red. There was a vase with one single red rose in it, which I still own. I took it with me in my final performance. There was a drop, a red ruby drop, on Lucy's dress, a teardrop somewhere, and I'm damned if I can remember what the third drop of... Oh, wine. There was a glass of red wine in one act, the flower in another, and the teardrop in the third.
Frank Langella, who starred as the Count. Gorey won the Tony Award for his designs, and the play ran for 3 years. The proceeds even enabled him to buy a house in Cape Cod, the house that Dracula built.
The great, great body of his work has nothing to do with Dracula, and very often it happens to people that one thing that they may not want to become their imprimatur does. And in this instance, I think Edward, who's probably up there somewhere, drawing little figures in clouds, probably thinks I wish Dracula had never happened. As much as it probably happened happily financially, I don't think it was anything he wanted to be a lasting memory for him.
In fact, Gorey hated being typecast as gothic or macabre.
It sort of annoys me to be stuck with that label. I don't think that's what I do exactly. I know I do it, but what I'm really doing is something else entirely. It just looks like I'm doing that.
So what exactly, we might well ask, is Gorey doing?
For some reason, my mission in life is to make everyone as uneasy as possible. I think we should all be as uneasy as possible, because that's what the world is like. The surrealist writers thought the most mysterious thing of all is just everyday life. I agree. Everyday life is very discomforting. I'm trying to convey that discomforting texture in my work.
One of his most gleefully discomforting works is The Gashly Crumb Tinies, or After the Outing, another of the little alphabet books, which are never as simple as ABC.
A is for Amy, who fell down the stairs. B is for Basil, assaulted by bears. C is for Clara, who wasted away. D is for Desmond, thrown out of a sleigh.
It's decorated with utterly charming pictures of prim and sedate Edwardian children seen in the moment before tragedy strikes. Little Ernest is seated in a high-backed chair at a vast baronial table, which is empty save for the servant's bell and a peach on a plate. He's just about to tuck in.
E is for Ernest, who choked on a peach. F is for Fanny, sucked dry by a leech.
G is for George, smothered under a rug. H is for Hector, done in by a thug.
As you may have gathered, this is a cautionary tale with no discernible moral whatsoever. But why is it so funny? Partly, of course, it's the contrast between the decorous little drawings and the casual violence of the verses.
I is for Ida, who drowned in a lake. J is for James, who took lie by mistake. K is for Kate, who was struck by an axe. L is for Leo, who swallowed some tacks. M is for Maud, who was swept out to sea. N is for Neville, who died of ennui. O is for Olive, run through with an awl. P is for Prue, trampled flat in a brawl. Q is for Quentin, who sank in a mire. R is for Rhoda, S is for Susan, who perished of fits. T is for Titus, who flew into bits.
There's some which only look good with the pictures, but some of them are really brilliant, the pictures. Like V is for Victor, squashed by a train. And it's got a picture of Victor looking one way, and you can just about guess where the train's coming.
U is for Una, who slipped down a drain. V is for Victor, squashed under a train. W is for Winnie, embedded in ice. X is for Xerxes, devoured by mice. Y is for Yorick, whose head was knocked in. Z is for Zilla, who drank too much gin.
People are shocked by the gastrocrumb tinies. They're curious why children are often the victims of his stories. And children become a metaphor for vulnerability.
Alone in the world was poor little lamb, as sweet a young child as you'd find. Her parents had gone to their final reward, leaving their baby behind. Did you hear this poor little child was only nine?
His books are also achingly funny because they pervert the genre so cleverly. In The Hapless Child, Charlotte Sophia is orphaned and sent off to a horrible boarding school. She flees and falls into the hands of a drunken brute who sets her to work making artificial flowers.
She made artificial flowers, artificial flowers, flowers for ladies of fashion to wear.
But there is no happy ending for Charlotte Sophia.
You know those artificial flowers, fashioned from Annie's despair.
Her eyesight begins to fail. Meanwhile, her father, who is not dead after all, returns to England and motors through the streets searching for her. But by now, she is almost blind. She runs out into the street and gets run over, at the end, by her apparently dead father.
There's so little heartless work around. So I feel I am filling a small but necessary gap.
The suspicion remains that Gorey's work isn't heartless at all. It may seem to represent a rather beady point of view. Horrible things just kind of happen in an arbitrary way, which he would claim was based on life. And yet, perhaps Gorey's work is actually his way of dealing with life.
We have to think that maybe writing books like this was a way for Ted Gorey to deal with his sense of the horrors that there are in the world.
A was an author who went for a walk.
Gorey suddenly decided the time was right to abandon New York and live full-time in Cape Cod, so he upped and left, taking his cats, of course. He continued to write and illustrate books, but increasingly found himself drawn back to the theater.
I started putting on plays. They're not like reviews because they don't start and stop. They just sort of drivel along without interruption. I've got a lot of manuscripts I've never illustrated, so I do those. At first I think, well, there's no way of putting this on the stage. And then I think, oh, sure there is. If you write a book and then illustrate it, that's it. All the possibilities that were there, except for the ones that you did, have automatically been cancelled out. But with the theater, you can do the same piece, and it's never the same, any two nights in a row. I direct, I design, I do everything. A lot of the people I cast are people who look as if I might have drawn them.
Jack Bragginton Smith is a local historian in Yarmouth Port, the small town in Cape Cod where Gorey settled. Jack also owns a restaurant called Jack's Outback. And over breakfast, he talked to me about his good friend, Edward Gorey.
We went to every play that he did down here. And he did a monumental number of plays. He loved that. And he had a group of amateur actors. And they were strange plays. And the actors themselves got accustomed to coming out for the second act with one-third of the audience there, two-thirds had left. But that's how it was. And Edward would roar. He would laugh at lines and whatnot. He'd sit in the back of the theater. And so it was a beautiful experience that he didn't care if anybody came or not. He was presenting it, and he did it, and he thoroughly enjoyed doing it. And they were great shows. I didn't understand half of them, but I understood the humor behind them.
I think it's true that in a way, everything he did was partly to entertain himself rather than to please the public. And of course, that's one way to create great work, and certainly a way to create individual and interesting work. He wasn't trying to make money. He wasn't trying to write bestsellers. He was drawing and writing what interested him and amused him and excited him.
There's some demand for my work, but it isn't exactly staggering. I have kind of an ardent little following, but the accent is on little. My name turns up in a review of a book or something where they say, "It's very Edward Gorey-ish." And so I feel I've made a tiny mark somewhere.
A lot of people would say, "Oh, please, Gorey is pure whimsy and self-indulgent in violent and dark moments, and that he's just macabre by nature." Not true at all. He's a very gentle man, a very shy person, not prone at all to be sympathetic to violence or macabre, grotesque things. He's a man struggling and dealing with some very important issues, I think.
Jane Austen, at the end of Mansfield Park, said that famous thing, "Let other pens dwell on guilt and misery. I quit such odious subjects as soon as I can." Well, if you really analyze that, it doesn't mean that she has not been writing about guilt and misery. She's written about it only to the extent that it's absolutely necessary to get it across. And as soon as she's got it across, she's not going to wallow in it. I mean, my favorite genre is sinister / cozy. There's a German word, gemütlich, which is the word for cozy, but with the negative attached, gemütlich ungemütlich, settled and unsettling, cozy and sinister. I think there should be a little bit of uneasiness in everything, because I do think we're all really, in a sense, living on the edge. So much of life is inexplicable. The things that happen to you are usually the things that you haven't thought of or that come absolutely out of nowhere. And all you can do is cope with them when they turn up.
In the year 2000, Edward Gorey was 75 years old.
I probably didn't see him for the last 10 years of his life. Now I regret that very much. Why did I not get on a plane and rent a car and go and see him? But you always think you have all the time in the world.
I thought he'd be around forever anyway, so what the hell's the difference? Then he had the nerve to get up and die.
This is the Osbick Bird, which was the only piece that Gorey had written that was read out at his memorial service. An Osbick bird flew down and sat on Embless Fingby's bowler hat. It had not done so for a whim, but meant to come and live with him. On Fridays, Embless played the flute. The bird now joined him on a lute. The top of the zagava tree was frequently where they had tea. They sometimes strolled beyond the town in time to watch the sun go down. The cards got battered past repair as they played double solitaire, and after that they would not speak to one another for a week. They went to Perivu by car, and places twice again as far. In winter they were both discreet and wore galoshes on their feet. Upon the river Ode, the two were often seen in their canoe. The years passed by in pressing weeds and making bell pulls out of beads. And when at last poor Emblis died, the Osbic bird was by his side. He was interred, the bird alone was left to sit upon his stone. But after several months, one day, it changed its mind and flew away.
Actress Catherine Kilgren. Edward Gorey left quite a tidy fortune to charities concerned with the care of various living creatures, including, fittingly enough, bats. Alison Lurie's obituary for the New York Review of Books ended with these words. Often, characters in Gorey's books who die or disappear leave only a void behind, empty cross-hatched streets and withered formal gardens and rooms with strange wallpaper. We are luckier. Quite so. We still have his work.
Mr. Earbrass stands on the terrace at twilight. It is bleak, it is cold, and the virtue has gone out of everything. Words drift through his mind. Anguish. Turnips. Conjunctions. Illness. Defeat. String. Urns. Desuetude. Disaffection. Trebizond. Napkins. Fever. Antipodes. Mush. Glaciers. Incoherence. Labels. Miasma. Amputation. Tides. Deceit. Mourning. Elsewords.
In Britain, the Guardian's obituary noticed a delightfully Gorey-esque detail. The Reuters report of his death ends with what might easily have been the final caption in one of his own spare, bleak picture stories. It was not clear if there were any survivors.
Now, at dawn, Mr. Earbrass stands, quite numb with cold and trepidation, looking at the churning surface of the channel. He assumes he will be horribly sick for hours and hours, but it doesn't matter. Though he is a person to whom things do not happen, perhaps they may, when he is on the other side.
You've been listening to The Gorey Details, starring David Suchet as Edward Gorey, reading from The Unstrung Harp, The Gashly Crumb Tinies, and The Doubtful Guest. Other extracts were drawn from an anthology of interviews with Edward Gorey, edited by Karen Wilkin. The program was compiled and presented by Philip Glassborough and featured Andreas Brown, Alison Lurie, Frank Langella, Catherine Kilgren, Jack Braginton-Smith, Stephen Appleby, and Alexander Hand. The producer was Beattie Rubens. The BBC is also grateful for the special contribution of Wardour Edgy, Miss D. Audrey Gore, Regera Dowdy, and Ogdred Weary.
BBC Radio 4, the news at 3 o'clock.